We've encountered the author, Timothy Good, before in what teaching I've done on the UFOs. This is a little book more recently edited by Timothy Good, The UFO Report. I think Christians ought not to cut the top of their head off, really. If anything, encounter with the one who said, I am the way, the truth, and the life, ought to open your mind, not close it. My gripe about traditional Christianity for years is it closes minds. Encounter with the source of all truth should open your mind, not close it. Why be scared of UFOs? Ezekiel certainly saw one, took off in one. I got to, Peter, move around all these cameras and turn the sound off because I'm hearing the director's voice. I don't know which ones it is, but turn them all off. UFO lands in Suffolk, and that's official. Was that one on? This is by Ralph Noyes. Ralph Noyes was born in the tropics. Spent most of his childhood in the West Indies. He served in the RAF 1940 to 46 as a navigator, engaging in active service in North Africa and the Far East. And don't take any more calls, by the way. Not too many people calling anyway, are there? He entered the civil service in 1949 and served in the Air Ministry and subsequently the Unified Ministry of Defense. For nearly 4 years, he headed Defense Secretariat 8, the acronym being DS-8, which, among other tasks, logged UFO reports from members of the public. Ralph Noyes retired in 1977, leaving in the grade of Under Secretary of State. He has since pursued a writing career and has written a number of articles and science fiction stories. In 1989, Country Life published several articles by him in the Mystery Cornfield Circles. And this particular chapter of this little book edited by Timothy Good is by Ralph Noyes. Headline, UFO lands in Suffolk, and that's official. These were the words in which a British Sunday newspaper told us in October 1983 of one of the most remarkable UFO cases in British history. The events they were reporting had taken place nearly 3 years before, in December 1980, in Rendlesham Forest in the English county of Suffolk. Now, almost a decade after these events, much more has come to light, and we've had time to draw conclusions. No apologies need be offered for retelling this extraordinary story. It encapsulates many of the central problems of UFOlogy or ufology. I call these incidents the Rendlesham case, after the pine forest in which the events took place. Other commentators have used other names, including the Bentwaters case and the Woodbridge case. Why is the Rendlesham case important? In most UFO cases, we have nothing more to go on than what a witness is able to tell us, often some days or weeks after the event, and not infrequently after the lapse of months or even years. If we are lucky, there may be two or more people who claim to have seen the same event. At the end of the investigation, we're left with our notes of what the witnesses have told us, supplemented perhaps by a rough sketch of the site and an artist's impression of whatever, quote, entities and or, quote, vehicles form part of the narrative. Increasing shrewdness, painfully learned over several decades, forces us to reduce most of these laboriously gathered stories to the probable misperception of something quite ordinary, or rather rarely, to hoax. What remains when these IFOs, that is, identified flying objects, have been eliminated makes up the hard core of our great cases, those bizarre and puzzling reports for which no conventional explanation seems possible, and which continue to interest those many of us who suspect that behind all this smoke, there must be some important fire. But the hard evidence which might convince our critics, or even persuade ourselves, tends to remain woefully absent. As elusive, indeed, as the clinching facts which, for more than a century, have been sought by those engaged in psychical research in pursuit of their own surprisingly similar dreams, hunches, and Eldorados. The crucial importance of the Rendlesham case is that we have the signed statement of a relatively senior officer of the United States Air Force, Lieutenant Colonel, now Brigadier General, Charles I. Holt, the then Deputy Base Commander of the important U.S. Air Force complex at RAF, Royal Air Force, Bentwaters Woodbridge in Suffolk, submitted to the British Ministry of Defense shortly after the alleged events occurred. The receipt of this document by the British Ministry of Defense has been formally acknowledged in the British House of Commons by the responsible minister, even though it took more than 2 years to wring out this statement following a long period of denials and prevarications. And Colonel Holt has repeatedly confirmed that it was indeed he who signed it. Whatever interpretation we care to place on this document, and much of this article will be concerned with interpreting it, there can be no doubt that it was officially issued by an officially appointed U.S. authority to an official British governmental agency. The importance of this fact can hardly be exaggerated. It is unique in British ufology. Although diligent research by ufologists has turned up some interesting cases in which the British Minister of Defense were undoubtedly involved. For example, the Bentwaters Lake and Heath incidents of August 1956. Wouldn't you like to know what that was? We may get to that. And the occurrences at RAF West Roy in April 1957. And I've already referred to Timothy Good's book above, Top Secret, which does describe those incidents. No definitive statement has ever been issued about them. And I doubt, as a former official of the department, that anything ever will be. The Holt Memorandum is altogether special in being an official and officially authenticated statement. Few other documents match it in this respect. I can think of nothing except certain of the releases made in the United States under the American Freedom of Information Act and reproduced by Lawrence Fawcett and Barry Greenwood in clear intent, and to a greater extent by Timothy Good and above Top Secret. As that Sunday paper put it, quote, UFO lands in Suffolk and that's official. It was those last three words which persuaded me for the first time in my life to buy that particular scandal sheet. Having bought it, I knew that the case was critical. What happened at Rendlesham? Great difficulties have dogged all students of this case, partly as the result of deliberate obfuscation by the U.S. Air Force, the Pentagon, and the British Ministry of Defense. How much deceit must our government continue to engage in before America wakes up? That the illusion of government by the people, of the people, for the people, long since ceased to exist in this country. Great difficulties have dogged all students of this case, partly as the result of deliberate obfuscation by the U.S. Air Force, the Pentagon, and the British Ministry of Defense. Partly because the wide range of alleged witnesses, many of them demanding anonymity, have told an equally wide range of conflicting stories. Partly because UFO skeptics have strenuously sought to distort facts in favor of their own views. And partly, alas, because some serious researchers have followed their prejudices and suspicions, and in some cases sheer lack of judgment, to introduce wholly unnecessary complications. Credit must always go to the authors of Sky Crash for the immense efforts which they devoted to this case and for producing the only full-length book we yet have, and I'm sure that Sky Crash will sell out of all bookstores that it's in. Nothing can detract from the dedication with which they pursued an exceptionally difficult investigation. But the book remains irretrievably marred by the attempt of the authors to combine their account of the case with a travelogue of their researchers and to report a number of irrelevancies which range from the naive to the unwittingly comic. To take merely one example, I doubt that any of us has much to learn from the account on page 35 of Sky Crash of the unfortunate mishap which two of the authors suffered while driving their car along a rutted dirt track at a considerable distance from the supposed UFO landing site more than a year later. I agree. The book remains, however, a mine of potential information, and I still think people will go buy it, and also a minefield of dubious speculation without so much as an index or an attempted calendar of events. The most convincing attempt to give us a connected narrative, while at the same time fully exposing the difficulties which beset us, is given by Timothy Good. This is indispensable reading for anybody coming fresh to the case. Since above Top Secret was written, Timothy Good's book, we have had the interesting research undertaken by Dr. Jameson of the State University of New York. It is surprising that Jameson fails to indicate any awareness of Good's book or of the highly significant investigations undertaken in the United States by Raymond W. Bosch, but his article is useful in clearly establishing the U.S. Air Force chain of command at Bentwaters Woodbridge at the relevant time and in placing beyond reasonable doubt that it was Halt, the fourth down in that top echelon, who led a party of his subordinates into Rendlesham Forest on December 29, 30th, 1980. This provides further collateral for those of us, myself included, who have always held, since the release of Halt's memorandum was secured under the U.S. Freedom of Information Act in June 1983, parent 2.5 years after the events it reports, that Halt was an eyewitness to the events of December 29 and 30, and that his memorandum is the key document. In answer to the question which heads this section, what happened at Rendlesham? I believe that we are right to take Halt as the one and only first-hand source whose report is on the official record. All else, important though much of it is, rests on hearsay and requires the caution with which we must always approach the second hand. Is the Halt memorandum a truthful account? Hawke's statement to the British Ministry of Defense, signed on January 13, 1981, reports the following. Come, Peter, and get a handheld camera. Reports the following. Roughly a fortnight after the events it describes. Are you unfamiliar with the British fortnight way of talking? 2 weeks. And I quote Hawke's statement. A. Turn that headset down. A. Am I boring you?
No, sir.
In the small hours of the morning on December 27th, 1980, three U.S. Air Force patrolmen encountered a strange glowing object of not inconsiderable size in a part of Rendlesham Forest adjoining the back gate of the Woodbridge Air Base. The object possessed some of the characteristics of a structured vehicle. It was metallic in appearance and triangular in shape. 2 to 3 meters across the base and roughly 2 meters high. Here, Peter, is a photocopy of the Department of Air Force memorandum entitled Unexplained Lights to the RAF, signed by Charles Hawke, Lieutenant Colonel at the time, U.S. Air Force Base, Deputy Base Commander. That's all I need from you, Peter. As the patrolman approached it, because I'm reading the excerpts, it maneuvered away from them and disappeared. An hour later, however, it was briefly seen again outside the back gate. B. The next day, three depressions in the ground were discovered where the object had been sighted. The next day could conceivably, the editor here adds, mean the daylight hours of December 27th or possibly the day of December 28th. And some commentators have made heavy weather of this ambiguity. My own view is that it's wholly unimportant, and I agree with the editor. All that's important is in the memorandum the next day, three depressions in the ground were discovered. I don't really care which day it was. C. On the night of December 29th, Hawke and numerous individuals took radiation readings in the area of the sighting, and later, over a period extending into the small hours of the morning of December 30th, they saw a succession of complex light phenomena both within the forest and subsequently in the sky. End of the excerpts. That, in essence, is all that Hawke tells us. There are strong indications that other much stranger things were taking place on the night of December 29th and 30th, and that the memorandum is, to say the least, deliberately tight-lipped and low-key. This has interesting implications on which I shall comment later. Immediately, however, we have to consider two possibilities which have been much discussed. First, that Hawke seriously misperceived something quite ordinary or was even the subject of hallucinations. Second, that he wrote his memorandum as a deliberate piece of misinformation for the concealment of some wholly mundane accident or military embarrassment. Those who want explanations of this kind have sought either to explain away the events which Holt describes or to describe the memorandum on some other grounds. Let us consider these ploys in turn. You interested? You say, why are you talking about UFOs? And I believe in them. You got to be an absolute nut to not believe there are flying objects that haven't been identified. And that's axiomatic. What do they represent? And that's what interests me. And I also want to illustrate that you can be a teacher of the Bible, not be afraid to explore these subjects. Because the Bible's full of UFOs. But if you want me to continue, you better get on the telephone.